hopeless. Even if he sprang at Caleb and knocked the pistol aside, 100 Mexicans would shoot him before he could flee. "I despise you for a coward," he said to Caleb, but he handed over his guns. Caleb shrugged and turned to Captain Salazar, who had come out of the tent in time to witness the little standoff.
"Captain, would you oblige me and put this man under heavy guard until he cools off?" Caleb asked. "He's too brash for his own damn good."
"Certainly, Colonel," Salazar said. "I'll assign 6 men."
Caleb looked at Call again. The young ranger was quivering, and the look in his eyes was a look of hatred.
"Assign 10, Captain," Caleb said. 6 men might could handle him if he decides to break out, but this is the man who shot Buffalo Hump's son. He'll fight if he sees any room."
"I don't care if you do call yourself Colonel," Call said. "You had no right to surrender us."
Caleb Cobb ignored him. He gave the skinny young officer the sidearm he'd just borrowed.
"Gracias," he said. "Corporal McCray, I want you to walk back over to that ridge where the troop is and tell them to give up their guns. Tell them they won't be hurt, and tell them they'll be fed as soon as they surrender."
"I'll go, Colonel, but they may not like the news," Gus said.
Caleb gestured toward the Mexican army, which had quickly surrounded the little group on the ridge. The infantry had formed a tight ring, with the cavalry massed in 2 lines outside it.
"We're not having an Alamo or a Goliad, not here," Caleb said. "Colonel Travis was a fool, though a brave fool. At least he had a church to fight in. We don't even have a tree to hide behind. This little war is over. Go along. Tell them that," he added. "The sooner you go, the sooner they'll get breakfast."
"Woodrow, hold steady," Gus said before leaving. "It won't help nobody for you to get killed."
Caleb Cobb went back into the general's tent. Nearby, 3 soldiers were hitching a team of sorrel mares to a fine buggy with a canvas canopy over it. Gus gave Call's arm a squeeze and started walking back toward the ridge where the troop waited. He had assumed a few Mexicans would go along to keep an eye on him, but none did. He walked out of the Mexican camp alone through the blowing grass. A group of 10 soldiers, led by Captain Salazar, surrounded Call and marched him about 100 yards from the general's tent.
"Sit, Corporal. Rest yourself," Salazar said. "You have a very long walk ahead. Perhaps now that this foolish invasion is over, you would care to eat."
Call shook his head. He was still very angry.
"I'll eat when my friends can eat," he said. "What's this about a long walk? Colonel Cobb just said we'd be going to Mexico. Ain't we in Mexico?"
"New Mexico, yes," Salazar said. "But there is another Mexico, and that is where you're going. To the city of Mexico, in fact." "That's where the trial will be held," he went on. "Or it will be, if any of you survive the long march."
"How far is the city of Mexico?" Call asked.
"I don't know, senor," Salazar admitted. "I have never had the pleasure of going there."
"Well, is it 100 miles?" Call asked. "That's a long enough walk if we're just going to be shot at the end of it."
Salazar looked at him in surprise.
"I see you know little geography," he said. "The city of Mexico is more than 1,000 miles away. It may be 2,000. As I said, I have never been there, but it is a long walk."
"Hell, that's too far," Call said. "I don't care to walk my feet off just to get someplace where I'll be put up against a wall and shot. I've done walked a far piece getting here from Texas. I don't care to walk another 1,000 miles, and the boys won't care to either."
"You may not care to, but you will go," Salazar said. "You will go and you will be tried properly. We are not barbarians. We do not condemn men without a fair trial."
Call accepted another cup of coffee, but he didn't eat, nor did he encourage any more conversations with Captain Salazar or anyone. Across the plain he could see Gus walking. He had not even reached the company yet to inform them of Caleb's treachery. Call wished he could be walking with him, so he could encourage the rangers to fight, even if to the death. It would be better to die than to submit to captivity again. But Gus was gone, and he was guarded too closely to attempt to follow. He was being watched, not only by the 10 soldiers who had been assigned to him, but by most of the soldiers still in camp. In the darkness he would have tried it, but the clouds were thinning. It was bright daylight. Patches of sunlight struck the prairie through the thinning clouds. Gus was walking in a patch of light toward the ridge. As Call sat surrounded, trying to control his bitter anger, General DiMaggio came out of the white tent with Caleb Cobb just behind him.
The two men, accompanied by the general's orderlies, walked to the fancy buggy and got in. Call had supposed the general was about to leave. Why else hitched the buggy? But he was shocked when Caleb got in the buggy with the general. The general was drinking liquor, not from a flask, but from a heavy jar, as they waited for the soldier who was to drive the buggy. Caleb had no jar, but as Call watched, he extracted another cigar from his shirt pocket and carefully readied it for lighting. The soldier who was to drive the team hopped up in his seat, and the buggy swung around to the west. 8 cavalrymen fell in behind it. As the general and his guest started out of camp, the general stopped the buggy for a moment in order to say something to Captain Salazar. Call was sitting only a few yards from where the buggy stopped. The sight of Caleb, his own commander, sitting at ease with the Mexican general, caused his anger to rise even higher. Call got to his feet, watching. Captain Salazar sent a soldier running back to the tent. The general had forgotten his fur lap robe. In a moment the soldier came out of the tent with it, being careful to keep the end of the robe from dragging on the wet ground. The robe was almost as heavy as the soldier who was carrying it. Before anyone could stop him, Call stepped closer to the buggy. "Where are you running to?" he asked Caleb. There was such anger in his voice that the 10 soldiers who were guarding him all flinched. Caleb Cobb himself looked surprised and annoyed. He had already consigned Call to the past and did not appreciate being approached so boldly.
"Why to Santa Fe, Corporal?" Caleb said. "General DiMaggio says the governor wants to meet me. I think he plans to give me a little banquet."
Call decided it would be worth dying just to strike the coward once. At least his body decided it. In a second he was charging through the startled soldiers. He even managed to snatch a musket as he ran past, but he didn't get a good grip on it and the musket fell to the ground. He kept running. His wild charge spooked the high-strung buggy horses, both of whom leaped into the air, jerking the driver off the buggy right under the horse's feet. It was a light buggy, and Call hit it while it was slightly tipped from the team's leap. Caleb and the general lurched forward on the buggy seat. Call leapt for Caleb and hit him once. Then as the buggy was tipping, he grabbed the heavy glass jar the general had been drinking from and smashed Caleb with it, flattening his nose and also his fresh cigar. The jar broke in Caleb's face. Blood and whiskey poured down his chest. Soon 4 men were squirming in the overturned buggy, which the frantic horses were dragging slowly forward on its side. The driver was caught under one of the wheels and groaned loudly every time the horses moved. For a second, the whole Mexican camp was paralyzed. They all stood stunned while one Texan caused their general's buggy to tip over. General DiMaggio was near the bottom of the pile, and Call was still pounding at Caleb with his bloody fist. After the first shock, though, the Mexicans regained their power of motion. Soon 50 rifles were leveled at Call.
"Don't shoot!" Captain Salazar yelled in Spanish. "You'll hit the general! Use your bayonets! Stick this man! Stick him!"
The nearest soldier did manage to bayonet Call in the calf, but before anyone else could stab him, General DiMaggio struggled to his feet and ordered them to stop.
"El Fierro!"
he said, looking at Call, whose hands were bleeding as badly as Caleb Cobb's face. Several soldiers, all with their bayonets raised to deal the Texan a fatal wound, were startled by the general's order, but all obeyed it. The first blow with the whiskey bottle had rendered Caleb unconscious, but Call was still trying to strike him.
"I think Colonel Cobb's jaw is broken," Salazar said. Though the man's face was very bloody, it seemed to him that his jaw had dropped at an odd angle.
Call wanted to kill Caleb Cobb, but he had no weapon. The few shards of glass around him were all too small to stab with. Before he could get a grip on Caleb's bloody neck to strangle him, the Mexicans began to drag him off. It was not easy. Call was bent on killing the man, and he flailed so that the soldiers kept losing their grip. Finally, one looped a horsehide rope over one of Call's legs, and they pulled him off. A dozen men piled on him and finally held him steady enough that they could truss him hand and foot. Just before they pulled him off, Call pounded Caleb's head against the edge of the wagon wheel seat, opening a split in his forehead. He failed in his purpose, though. Caleb Cobb was damaged, but he was not injured fatally. Through the legs of the men standing over him, many of them panting from the struggle, Call saw several Mexicans help Caleb Cobb to his feet. Caleb's face and forehead were dripping blood, but once he cleared his head, he hobbled through the soldiers and broke into the circle where Call lay tied. Without a word, he grabbed a musket from the nearest soldier and raised it high to bayonet Call where he lay. But Captain Salazar was quicker. Before Caleb struck, he stepped in front of him and leveled a pistol at him.
"No, Colonel. Put down the gun," Salazar said.
I must remind you that this man is our prisoner, not yours.
Call looked at Caleb calmly. He had done his best to kill the man and was prepared to take the consequences. He knew that Caleb wanted his death. He could see the murderous urge in the man's eyes. With difficulty, Caleb mastered himself.
He turned the musket over, as if he meant to hand it back to the soldier he had borrowed it from. But then, in a whipping motion too quick for anyone to stop, he struck with the stock of the musket across both of Call's bound feet. The blow was so sudden and painful that Call cried out. Caleb immediately handed the musket back to the soldier he had borrowed it from and hobbled back toward the buggy. Call twisted in pain. Through the legs of his captors, he could see the buggy being righted. The horses, still jumpy, were being held by three men each. General DiMaggio stood by the buggy talking to Captain Salazar. Now and then, the general gestured toward Call. The company barber had been hastily summoned to pick the glass out of Caleb's face and neck. The barber wiped the blood away with a rag as best he could, but several cuts were still bleeding freely. He took the rag from the barber and dabbed at the cuts himself. General DiMaggio climbed back into the buggy and Caleb after him. The canopy was sitting a little crookedly. The driver had survived. He turned the buggy and the eight cavalrymen fell in behind it again as it left the camp. The buggy went at a good clip. Soon the general and Caleb Cobb were nearly to the mountains. Captain Salazar strolled over and stood looking down at Call, who was still surrounded by soldiers ready to bayonet him if he gave them an excuse.
"You are a brave young man, but foolish," Salazar said. "Your colonel had no choice but to surrender. His men had no food and no ammunition. If he hadn't surrendered, we would have killed you all."
"I despise him," Call said. "At least he won't look so pretty at his damn banquet."
"You're right about that," Salazar said. "But the governor's wife will enjoy him anyway. She likes adventurers."
"I despise him," Call said again.
"I'm afraid you will not look so good either once we have whipped you," Salazar said. "The general admired your mettle so much that he ordered 100 lashes for you. A great honor."
Call looked at Captain Salazar but said nothing. His feet still pained him badly. He had supposed there would be more punishment coming, too. After all, he had knocked the fat general out of his fancy buggy, turned the buggy over, caused the driver to get partly crushed by a wagon wheel, and bent the canopy of the buggy out of shape.
50 lashes is usually enough to kill a man, Corporal," Captain Salazar went on. "You will have to eat heartily before this punishment, if you hope to live."
"Why would I need to eat, especially?" Call asked.
"Because you won't have any flesh left on your ribs," the captain said. "The whip will take it off."
Then he smiled and turned away.
Gus was walking up the little slope toward the ranger troop when suddenly a cheer went up. He looked up to see that the men were all waving their guns and hooting. At first he thought they were merely welcoming him back, but when he looked more closely he saw that they were looking beyond him toward the Mexican camp. He turned to see what the commotion was about and saw that the general's buggy had been overturned somehow. At first he supposed it was merely some accident with the horses. Good buggy horses were often too high-strung to be reliable. When he saw there was a melee and that Call was in the middle of it, his stomach turned over. Call was in the overturned buggy, pounding at Caleb Cobb. Then he saw a soldier bayonet Call in the leg. Several more soldiers had their bayonets up, ready to stab Call when they could. Gus didn't want to watch, but was unable to turn away. He knew his friend would be dead in a few seconds. But then, to Gus's surprise, Salazar stepped in and stopped the stabbing. He saw Caleb come over and strike at Call with the musket stock. Why he struck his feet rather than his head, Gus couldn't figure. He began to walk backward up the ridge so he could continue to watch the drama in the Mexican camp. Salazar came back and seemed to be having a talk with Call while Call lay on the ground. Gus didn't know what any of it meant. All he could be sure of was that Caleb Cobb then left the camp with General DiMaggio. Call was tied up. No doubt he was in plenty of trouble for attacking the general's buggy. He soon gave up walking backward. The ground was too rough. The boys were close by anyway. Some were coming down the ridge to meet him. The Mexican infantry stood in a ring around them, just out of rifle range.
"So what's the orders? Why did Caleb leave?" Bigfoot asked when Gus walked up to the troop.
"The orders are to surrender our weapons," Gus said. "Call didn't like them. I guess that's why he knocked over the buggy."
"Well, he was bold," Bigfoot said. "I expect they'll put him up against the wall of a church, like they did Bess."
They would have already, only there's no church available, Blackie Slidell said.
Where did Caleb bounce off to with the fat general? Bigfoot asked. Gus didn't know the answer to that question, or to most of the questions he was asked. He couldn't get his mind off the fact that Woodrow Call was probably going to be executed, and very soon. He had never had a friend as good as Woodrow Call. It was in his mind that he should have stayed and fought with him, and been killed too, side by side with his friend.
"Caleb is a damn skunk," Long Bill Coleman said. "He had no right to surrender for us. What if we'd rather fight?"
"What happens to us if we do surrender?" Jimmy Tweed asked. "Will they put us all against the church?"
"Oh, they need two churches at least for all of us," Bigfoot said. "That church where they shot Bess was no bigger than a hut. They'd have to shoot us in shifts if they used a church that small."
"Shut up about the churches. They ain't going to shoot us," Gus said. He was annoyed by Bigfoot's habit of holding lengthy discussions of ways they might have to die. If he had to be dead, he wanted it to occur with less conversation from Bigfoot Wallace.
"We can have breakfast as soon as we give up our guns," he added. To the hungry men, cold, wet, and discouraged, the notion of breakfast was a considerable inducement to compromise.
"I wonder if they've got bacon," Jimmy Tweed asked. "I might surrender to the rascals if I could spend the morning eating bacon."
"There's no pigs over there," Matilda observed. "I guess they could have brought bacon with them, though."
"What do you think, Shad?" Bigfoot asked.
Shadrach had picked up a little at the prospect of battle. There was a keen light in his eye that had been missing since he got his cough and had begun to repeat himself in conversations. He was walking back and forth in front of the troop, his long rifle in his hand. The fact that they were completely surrounded by Mexican infantry with a substantial body of cavalry backing them up was not lost on him, though. He kept looking across the plain and then to the mountains beyond. The plain offered no hope. It was entirely open. They would be cut down like rabbits, but the mountains were timbered. If they could make it to cover, they might survive. The problem with that strategy was the Mexican camp lay directly between them and the hills. They would have to fight their way through the infantry, then through the cavalry, then through the camp. Several men were sickly and the ammunition was low. Much as he wanted to sight his long rifle time after time at Mexican breasts, he knew it would be a form of suicide. They were too few, with too little.
"We could run for them hills, shoot our way through," he said. "I doubt more than 5 or 6 of us would make it. We'd give them a scrap, at least, if we'd done that."
"Not a one of us would make it," Bigfoot said. "Of course, they might spare Matilda."
"I don't want to be spared if Shad ain't," Matilda said.
"You're a big target, Matty," Bigfoot observed in a kindly tone. "They might shoot you full of lead before they even realized you were female."
"Why do we have to fight?" Gus asked. "They have us surrounded, and we're outnumbered 10 to 1. More than that, I guess. We can't whip that many of them, even if they are Mexicans. If we surrender, we won't be hurt. Caleb said that himself. We'll just be prisoners for a while, and we can have breakfast."
"I am damn hungry," Blackie Slidell said. "A few tortillas wouldn't hurt."
"All right, boys. There are too many," Bigfoot said. "Let's lay our guns down. Maybe they'll just march us over to Santa Fe and introduce us to some pretty senoritas."
"I think they'll line us up and shoot us," Johnny Carthage said. "I'm for the breakfast, though. I hope there's a good cook."
The Rangers carefully laid down their weapons in full view of a captain of the infantry. They piled the guns in a heap and raised their hands. The captain who received their surrender was very young, about Gus's age. Relief was in his face when he saw that the Rangers had decided not to fight.
"Gracias, señores," he said. "Now come with us and eat."
"There's one good thing about surrendering," Gus said to Jimmy Tweed as they were marching.
"What?" Jimmy asked. "Señoritas?"
"No. Weapons. Lots of guns. And they've got that cannon," Gus said. "It ought to be enough to keep off the bears."
"Oh, bears," Jimmy said casually.
"You ain't even seen one," Gus said. "You wouldn't be so reckless if you had."
The whip was made in Germany, Captain Salazar said as Carl was being tied to the wheel of one of the supply wagons. "I have never been in Germany," he added, "but it seems they make the best whips."
The whole Mexican force had been assembled to watch Carl's punishment. The Texans were lined up just behind him. Many of them were in a very foul temper since the promised breakfast had turned out to consist of flavorless tortillas and very weak coffee.
None of them had had a chance to talk to Call, who was under heavy guard. He was marched by armed men, with bayonets fixed, to the wagon, where he was tied. His shirt was removed, too. One of the muleteers was to do the whipping, a heavy-set man with only one or two teeth in his mouth. The whip had several thongs, each with a knot or two in them. The thongs were tipped with metal.
"I guess I won't be going to Germany if they're that fond of whips," Long Bill said. "I wouldn't want to be Woodrow. 100 times is a lot of times to be hit with a whip like that."
Matilda Roberts stood with the men, a look of baleful hatred in her eyes.
"If Carl don't live, I'll kill that snaggletooth bastard that's doing the whipping," she said.
Bigfoot Wallace was silent. He had seen men whip before, black men mostly, and it was a spectacle he didn't enjoy. He didn't like to see helpless men hurt. Of course, young Call had knocked over the general's buggy. Dignity required that he be punished to some extent, but 100 lashes with a metal-thonged whip was a considerable punishment. Men had died of less, as Captain Salazar was fond of reminding them.
"If you'd like to say a word to your friend Corporal McCrae, I'll permit it," Salazar said.
"No, I'll talk to him later," Call said. He didn't like the tone of familiarity Salazar adopted with him. He did not intend to be friends with the man, didn't want to enter into conversation with him.
"Corporal, there may be no later," Salazar said. "You may not survive this whipping. As I told you earlier, 50 lashes kills most men."
"I expect to live," Call said.
Mainly what he remembered of the whipping was the warmth of blood on his back and the fact that the camp became very silent. The grunt of the muleteer who was whipping him was the only sound. After the first 10 blows, he didn't hear the whip strike. Gus heard it, though. He watched his friend's back become a red sheet. Soon Call's pants, too, were blood-soaked. The muleteer wore out on the 60th stroke and had to yield the bloody whip to a smaller man. Call was unconscious by then. All the rangers assumed he was dead. Matilda was restrained with difficulty from attacking the whipper. Call hung by his bound wrist, presenting a low target. The second whipper had to bend low in order to hit his back. When they untied Call and let him slide down beside the wagon wheel, they thought they were untying a corpse. But Call turned over, groaning. "By God, he's alive," Bigfoot said.
"For now," Salazar said. "It is remarkable. Few men survive 100 lashes.
"He'll live to bury you," Matilda said, giving Salazar a look of hatred.
"If I thought that were true, I would bury him right here and right now, alive or dead," Salazar said.
"Now be fair, Captain," Bigfoot said. "He's had his punishment. Don't go burying him yet."
No one could stand to look at Call's back except Matilda, who sat beside him that first night and kept the flies away. She had nothing to cover the wounds with. If too many of them festered, she knew the boy would die.
Gus McCrae had not been able to watch the whipping beyond the first few strokes. He sat with his back to the whipping ground, his head between his hands, grinding his teeth in agony. None of the Texans were tied, but a brigade of riflemen were stationed just beside them with muskets ready. Their orders were to shoot any man who tried to interfere with the punishment. None did, but Gus fought with himself all through the whipping. He wanted to dash at the whipper. His friend was being whipped to death, and he could do nothing about it. He had not even been able to exchange a word with Call before the whipping began. It was a terrible hour, during which he vowed over and over again to kill every Mexican soldier he could to avenge his friend. Now, though, with Call alive but still in mortal peril, he came and went. Every 10 minutes he would walk over to Matilda and ask if Call was still breathing. Once Matilda told him Call was alive, he would go back to where the Texans sat, plop down for a minute, and then get up and walk around restlessly until it was time to go check on Call again. There was a small creek near the encampment. Matilda persuaded an old Mexican who tended the fires and helped with the cooking to loan her a bucket so she could walk over to the creek and get water with which to wash Call's wounds. He was already delirious with fever. The cold water was the only thing she had to treat him with or clean his wounds. When she went to the creek, 3 soldiers went with her, a fact that annoyed her considerably. She didn't complain, though. They were captives. Call's life, as well as others, depended on caution now. Shadrach had spread his blanket near where Matilda sat with Call. He and Bigfoot were the only rangers who had watched the whipping through. Before it was over, most of the men like Gus had turned their backs.
"Oh, Lord,
Oh, Lord, Long Bill said many times as he heard the blows strike.
Was it me? I'd rather be put up against the wall, Blackie Slidell said. That way's quick.
Captain Salazar had been right in his assessment of the damage the whip would cause. In several places the flesh had been torn off Call's ribs. None of the Texans could stand to look at his back, except Bigfoot, who considered himself something of a student of wounds. He came over once or twice to squat by Call and examine his injuries. Shadrach took no interest. He thought the boy might live. Call was a tough one. What vexed him most was that the Mexicans had taken his long rifle. He had carried that gun for 20 years. Rare had been the night when his hand wasn't on it. For most of that time, the gun had not been out of his sight. He felt incomplete without it. The Texans' guns had all been piled in a wagon, a vehicle Shadrach kept his eye on. He meant to have his gun again. If that meant dying, then at least he would die with his gun in his hand. Shadrach slept cold that night. Matilda stayed with Carl, warming him with her body. He went from fever to chill, chill to fever. The old Mexican helped Matilda build a little fire. The old man seemed not to sleep. From time to time in the night, he came to tend the fire. Gus didn't sleep. He was back and forth all night. Matilda got tired of his restless visits.
You just as well sleep, she said. You can't do nothing for him.
Can't sleep, Gus said. He couldn't get the whipping out of his mind. Call's pants legs were stiff with blood. When dawn came, Call was still alive, though in great pain. Captain Salazar came walking over and examined the prisoner.
Remarkable, he said. We'll put him in the wagon. If he lives 3 days, I think he will survive and walk to the city of Mexico with us.
You don't listen, Matilda said, the hatred still in her eyes. I told you yesterday that he'd bury you.
Salazar walked off without replying. Call was lifted into one of the supply wagons. Matilda was allowed to ride with him. The Texans all walked behind the wagon under heavy guard. Johnny Carthage gave up his blanket so that Call could be covered from the chill. At mid-morning, the troop divided. Most of the cavalry went north, and most of the infantry, too. 25 horsemen and about 100 infantrymen stayed with the prisoners. Bigfoot watched this development with interest. The odds had dropped, and in their favor, though not enough. Captain Salazar stayed with the prisoners.
I am to deliver you to El Paso, he said. Now we have to cross these mountains.
All the Texans were suffering from hunger. The food had been scanty. Just the same tortillas and weak coffee they'd had for supper.
I thought we were supposed to get fed if we surrendered, Bigfoot said to Salazar.
All day the troop climbed upward toward a pass in the thin range of mountains. The Texans had been used to walking on a level plain. Walking uphill didn't suit them. There was much complaining, and much of it directed at Caleb Cobb, who had led them on a hard trip, only to deliver them to the enemy in the end. There were Mexicans on every side, though. All they could do was walk uphill, upward, into the cloud that covered the tops of the mountains.
The bears live up here, Bigfoot mentioned, lest anyone be tempted to slip off while they were climbing into the cloud.
When Call first came back to consciousness, he thought he was dead. Matilda had left the wagon to answer call of nature. They were in the thick of the cloud. All Call could see was white mist. The march had been halted for a while, and the men were silent, resting. Call saw nothing except the white mist, and he heard nothing either. He could not even see his own hand. Only the pain of his lacerated back reminded him that he still had a body. If he was dead, as for a moment he assumed, it was vexing to have to feel the pains he would feel if he were alive. If he was in heaven, then it was a disappointment, because the white mist was cold and uncomfortable. Soon, though, he saw a form in the mist, a large form. He thought perhaps it was the bear, though he had not heard that there were bears in heaven. Of course, he might not be in heaven. The fact that he felt the pain might mean that he was in hell. He had supposed hell would be hot, but that might just be a mistake the preachers made. Hell might be cold, and it might have bears in it, too. The large form was not a bear, though. It was Matilda Roberts. Call's vision was blurry. At first he could only see Matilda's face hovering near him in the mist. It was very confusing.
In his hours of fever, he'd had many visions in which people's faces floated in and out of his dreams. Gus was in many of his dreams, but so was Buffalo Hump, and Buffalo Hump certainly did not belong in heaven. "Could you eat?" Matilda asked. Call knew then that he was alive and that the pain he felt was not hellfire, but the pain from his whipping. He knew he had been whipped 100 times, but he could not recall the whipping clearly. He had been too angry to feel the first few licks. Then he had become numb and finally unconscious. The pain he felt lying in the wagon in the cold mist was far worse than what he had felt while the whipping was going on. "Could you eat?" Matilda asked again. "Old Francisco gave me a little soup." "Not hungry," Carl said. "Where's Gus?" "I don't know. It's foggy, Woodrow," Matilda said. "Shad's coughing. He can't take much fog." "But Gus is alive, ain't he?" Carl asked, for in one of his hallucinations, Buffalo Hump had killed Gus and hanged him upside down from a post-oak tree. "I guess he's alive. He's been asking about you every 5 minutes," Matilda said. "He's been worried. We all have."
"I don't remember the whipping. I guess I passed out," Carl said.
"Yes, up around 60 licks, Matilda said. "Salazar thought you'd die, but I knew better."
"I'll kill him someday," Carl said. "I despise the man. I'll kill that mule skinner that whipped me, too."
"Oh, he left," Matilda said. "Most of the army went home."
"Well, if I can find him, I'll kill him," Carl said. "That is, if they don't execute me while I'm sick."
"No, we're to march to El Paso," Matilda said.
"We didn't make it when we tried to march to it from the other side," Carl reminded her.
Then a kind of red darkness swept over him and he stopped talking. Again the wild dreams swirled, dreams of Indians and bears. When Carl awoke the second time, they were farther down the slope. The sun was shining and Gus was there, but Carl was very tired. Opening his eyes and keeping them open seemed like a day's work. He wanted to talk to Gus, but he was so tired he couldn't make his lips move.
"Don't talk, Woodrow," Gus said. "Just rest. Matilda's got some soup for you."
Carl took a little soup but passed out while he was eating. For 3 days he was in and out of consciousness. Salazar came by regularly, checking to see if he was dead. Each time Matilda insulted him, but Salazar merely smiled. On the 4th day after the whipping, Salazar insisted that Carl walk. They were on the plain west of the mountains, and it had turned bitter cold. Carl's fever was still high. Even with Johnny Carthage's blanket, he was racked with a deep chill. For a whole night he could not keep still. He rolled one way and then the other. Matilda's loyalties were torn. She didn't want Carl to freeze to death or Shadrach either. The old man's cough had gone deeper. It seemed to be coming from his bowels. Matilda was afraid, deeply afraid. She thought Shad was going. Then any morning she would wake up and see his eyes wide in the stare of death. Finally, she lifted Carl out of the wagon and took him to where Shad lay. She put herself between the two men and warmed them as best she could. It was a clear night. Their breath made a cloud above them. They had moved into desert country. There was little wood, and what there was the Mexicans used for their own fires. The Texans were forced to sleep cold. The next morning, finding Carl out of the wagon, Salazar decreed that he could walk. Carl was semi-conscious. He didn't even hear the command, but Matilda heard it and was outraged.
"This boy can't walk. I carried him out of the wagon and put him here to keep him warm," she said. "This old man don't need to be walking either."
She gestured at Shadrach, who was coughing. Salazar had come to like Matilda. She was the only one of the Texans he did like, but he immediately rejected her plea.
"If we were a hospital, we would put the sick men in beds," he said. "But we are not a hospital. Every man must walk now."
"Why today?" Matilda asked. "Just let the boy ride one more day. With one more day's rest, he might live."
"To bury me?" Salazar asked. "Is that why you want him to live?"
He was trying to make a small jest.
"I just want him to live," Matilda said, ignoring the joke. "He's suffered enough."
"We have all suffered enough, but we are about to suffer more," Salazar said. "It is not just you Texans who will suffer either. For the next 5 days we will all suffer. Some of us may not live."
"Why?" Gus asked. He walked up and stood listening to the conversation.
"I don't feel like dying myself."
Salazar gestured to the south. They were in a sparse desert as it was. They had seen no animals all the day before and their water was low.
There is the Jornada del Muerto, he said. The dead man's walk.
What's he talking about? Johnny Carthage asked. Seeing that a parley was in progress, several of the Texans had wandered over, including Bigfoot Wallace.
Oh, so this is where it is, Bigfoot said. The dead man's walk. I've heard of it for years.
Now you will do more than hear of it, Señor Wallace, Salazar said. You will walk it. There is a village we must find today or tomorrow. Perhaps they will give us some melons and some corn. After that, we will have no food and no water until we have walked the dead man's walk.
How far across? Long Bill asked. I'm a slow walker, but if it's that hard, I'll try not to lag.
200 miles, Salazar said. Perhaps more. We will have to burn this wagon soon, maybe tonight. There is no wood in the place we are going.
The voices had filtered through the red darkness in which Carl lived. He opened his eyes and saw all the Texans around him. What is it, boys? He asked. It's frosty, ain't it? Woodrow, they want you to walk, Gus said. Do you think you can do it? I'll walk, Carl said. I don't like Mexican wagons anyway.
We'll help you, Corporal, Bigfoot said. We can take turns toting you if we have to.
It might warm my feet to walk a ways, Carl said. I can't feel my toes.
Cold feet was a common complaint among the Texans. At night the men wrapped their feet in anything they could find, but the fact was they couldn't find much. Few of them slept more than an hour or two. It was better to sit talking over their adventures than to sleep cold. The exception was Bigfoot Wallace, who seemed unaffected by cold. He slept well, cold or hot.
At least we've got the horses, he remarked. We can eat the horses like we done before.
I expect the Mexicans will eat the horses, Gus said. They ain't our horses.
Carl found hobbling on his frozen feet very difficult, yet he preferred it to lying in the wagon where all he had to think about was a fire across his back. He could not keep up, though. Matilda and Gus offered to be his crutches, but even that was difficult. His wounds had scabbed, and his muscles were tight. He groaned in deep pain when he tried to lift his arms across Gus's shoulders.
It's no good. I'll just hobble, he said. I expect I'll get quicker once I warm up.
Gus was nervous about bears. He kept looking behind the troop. He didn't see any bears, but he did catch a glimpse of a cougar, just a glimpse as the large brown cat slipped across a small gully. Just then there was a shout from the column ahead. A cavalryman, one of the advance guard, was racing back toward the troop at top speed, his horse's hooves kicking up little clouds of dust from the sandy ground.
"Now what's his big hurry?" Bigfoot asked. "You reckon he spotted a grizzly?"
"I hope not," Gus said. "I'm in no mood for bears."
Matilda and Shadrach were walking with the old Mexican Francisco. They were well ahead of the other Texans. All the soldiers clustered around the rider, who held something in his hand.
"What's he got there, Matty?" Bigfoot asked, hurrying up.
"The general's hat," Matilda said.
"That's mighty odd," Bigfoot said. "I've never knowed a general to lose his hat."
2 miles farther on, they discovered that General DiMaggio had lost more than his hat. He had lost his buggy, his driver, his cavalrymen, and his life. 4 of the cavalrymen had been tied and piled in the buggy before the buggy was set on fire. The buggy had been reduced almost to ash. The corpses of the 4 cavalrymen were badly charred. The other cavalrymen had been mutilated but not scalped. General DiMaggio had suffered the worst fate, a fate so terrible that everyone who looked at his corpse bent over and gagged. The general's chest cavity had been opened and hot coals had been scooped into it. All around lay the garments and effects of the dead men. Both the fine buggy horses had been killed and butchered.
"Whoever done this got off with some tasty horse meat," Bigfoot said.
Except for the burned cavalrymen, all the dead had several arrows in them.
"No scalps taken," Bigfoot observed.
"Apaches don't scalp. Ain't interested," Shadrach said. "They got better ways to kill you."
"He is right," Salazar said. "This is the work of Gomez. For a while he was in Mexico, but now he is here. He has killed 20 travelers in the last month. Now he has killed a great general."
"He wasn't great enough, I guess," Bigfoot said. "I thought he rode off with a skimpy guard. I guess I was right."
"Only Gomez would treat a general like this," Salazar said. "Most Apaches would sell a general if they caught one, but Gomez likes only to kill. He knows no law."
Bigfoot considered that sloppy thinking.
Well, he may know plenty of law, he said, but it ain't his law, and he don't mind breaking it.
Salazar received this comment irritably.
You will wish he knew more law if he catches you, he said. We are all in danger now.
I doubt he'd attack a party this big, Bigfoot said. Your general just had 11 men counting himself.
Salazar snapped his fingers. He just noticed something.
Speaking of counting, he said, where is your colonel? I don't see his corpse.
By God, I don't neither, Bigfoot said. Where is Caleb?
The coward. I expect he escaped, Carl said.
More than that, Gus said, he probably made a deal with Gomez.
No, Salazar said. Gomez is Apache. He is not like us. He only kills.
He might have taken Caleb home with him to play with, Long Bill suggested. I feel sorry for him if that's so, even though he is a skunk.
I doubt Caleb Cobb would be taken alive, Bigfoot said. He ain't the sort that likes to have coal shoveled into his belly.
Before the burials were finished, one of the infantrymen found Caleb Cobb, naked, blind, and crippled, hobbling through the sandy desert, about a mile from where the Apaches had caught the Mexicans. Caleb's legs and feet were filled with thorns. In his blindness, he had wandered into prickly pear and other cactus.
"Oh, boys, you found me," Caleb said hoarsely as he was helped into camp. "They blinded me with thorns, the Apache devils."
"They hamstrung him, too," Bigfoot whispered. "I guess they figured he'd starve or freeze."
"I expect that bear would have got him," Gus said.
Even Call, beaten nearly to death himself, was moved to pity by the sight of Caleb Cobb, a man he thoroughly despised. To be blind, naked, and crippled in such a thorny wilderness and in the cold was a harder fate than even cowards deserved.
"How many were they, Colonel?" Salazar asked.
"Not many," Caleb said in his hoarse voice. "Maybe 15. But they were quick. They came at us at dawn when we had the sun in our eyes. One of them clubbed me with a rifle stock before I even knew we were under attack."
For a moment he lost his voice and his ability to stand. He sagged in the arms of the two infantrymen who were supporting him. The leg that had been cut was twisted in an odd way.
15 ain't many, Gus said. He didn't like seeing men who had been tortured whether they were alive or dead.
Couldn't keep his mind off how it would feel to have the tortures happen to him. The sight of Caleb with his leg jerking, his eyes ruined, and his body blue with cold made him want to look away or go away. But of course he couldn't go away without putting himself in peril of the Apaches and the bears.
15 was enough, Bigfoot said. I've heard they come at you at dawn.
Captain Salazar was thinking of the journey they had to make. He kept looking south toward the dead man's walk. The quivering, ruined man on the ground before him was a handicap he knew he could not afford.
"Colonel, we have a hard march ahead," the captain said. "I am afraid you are in no condition to make this march. The country ahead is terrible. Even healthy men may not survive it. I am afraid you have no chance."
"Stick me in a wagon," Caleb said. "If I can have a blanket, I'll live."
"Colonel, we cannot take the wagons across these sands," Salazar said. "We'll have to burn them for firewood, probably tonight. They have blinded you and crippled you."
"I won't be left," Caleb said, interrupting the captain. "All I need is a good doctor. He can fix this leg."
"No, Colonel," Salazar said. "No one can fix your leg or your eyes. We can't take you across the sands. We have to look to ourselves."
"Then send me back," Caleb said. "If I can be put on a horse, I reckon I can ride it to Santa Fe."
There was anger in his voice. While they all watched, he managed to get to his feet. Even crippled, he was taller than Salazar, and he was determined not to die. Call was surprised by the man's determination.
"If he'd been that determined to fight, we wouldn't be prisoners," he whispered to Gus.
"He ain't determined for us, he's determined for himself," Gus pointed out. Salazar, though, was out of patience.
"I cannot take you, Colonel," he said. "And I cannot send you back either. If I sent you with a few men, Gomez would find you again, and this time he would do worse."
"I'll take that chance," Caleb said.
"But I won't take you, Colonel," Salazar said, drawing his pistol. "You are a brave officer. It is time to finish yourself."
The troops grew silent when Salazar drew his pistol. Caleb Cobb was balanced on one leg. The other foot scarcely touched the ground. Call saw the anger rise in his face. For a second he expected Caleb to go for Salazar,
but after a second Caleb controlled himself.
All right, he said. I never expected to die in a goddamn desert. I'm a seaman. I ought to be on my boat.
I know you were a great pirate, Salazar said, relieved that the man was taking matters calmly. You stole much treasure from the King of Spain.
I did, and lost it all at cards, Caleb said. I know you need to travel, Captain. Give me your pistol and I'll finish it. You can be on your way.
Would you like privacy? Salazar asked. He still held the pistol.
Why, no, not specially, Caleb said in a normal voice. These wild Texas boys are all mad at me for surrendering. They'll hang me if they get the chance. It will amuse me to cheat them by shooting myself.
All right, Salazar said.
How was that you said I ought to do it, Wallace? Caleb asked. Are you here, Wallace? I know you think there's a sure way. I want to take the sure way.
Through the eyeball, Bigfoot said.
It'll have to be through the eye hole, Caleb said. I'm all out of eyeballs.
Well, that will do just as well, Colonel, Bigfoot said.
I'll take the pistol now, if you please, Caleb said in a pleasant, normal voice.
Adios, Colonel, Salazar said, handing Caleb the pistol.
Caleb immediately turned the pistol on Salazar and shot him. The captain fell backward, clutching his throat.
Rush 'em, boys, get their guns, Caleb said. I'll take down a few.
But in his blindness, Caleb Cobb fired toward the Texans, not the Mexicans. Two shots went wild while the Texans ducked.
Hell, he's turned around, he's shooting at us,
Long Bill said as he ducked. Before Caleb could fire a fourth time, the Mexican soldiers recovered from their shock and cut him down. As he fell, he fired a last shot. Shadrach, who had been standing calmly by Matilda, fell backward stiffly. He was dead before he had time to be surprised.
Oh, no! No, not my Shad! Matilda cried, squatting down by Shadrach.
The Mexican soldiers continued to pour bullets into Caleb Cobb. The corpse had more than 40 bullets in it when it was buried. But the Texans had lost interest in Caleb. Bigfoot ripped open Shadrach's shirt, hoping the old man was stunned but not dead. But the bullet had taken Shadrach exactly in the heart.
What a pity, Captain Salazar said.
He was bleeding profusely from the wound in his throat. The wound, though, was only a crease.
Shad! Shad! Matilda said, trying to get the old man to answer, but Shadrach's lips didn't quiver.
This man had walked a dead man's walk, Salazar said. He might have guided us. Your colonel was already dead when he shot him. I supposed his finger twitched. We're having no luck today.
Well, you're having plenty of luck, Captain, Bigfoot said. If that bullet had hit your neck a fraction to the left, you'd be as dead as Shad.
True, Salazar said. I was very foolish to give Colonel Cobb my gun. He was a man like Gomez. He knew no law.
When Matilda Roberts saw that Shadrach was dead, she began to wail. She wailed as loudly as her big voice would let her. Her cries echoed off a nearby butte. Many men felt their hair stand up when the echo brought back the sound of a woman wailing in the desert. Many of the Mexican soldiers crossed themselves.
Now, Maddie, Bigfoot said, kneeling beside and putting his big arm around her. Now, Maddie, he's gone, and that's the fact.
I can't bear it. He was all I had, Matilda said, her big bosom, wet already with tears, heaving and heaving.
It's sad, but it might be providential, Bigfoot said. Shadrach wasn't well, and we have to cross the big dry. I doubt Shad would have made it. He'd have died hard, like some of us will.
Don't tell me that. I want him alive. I just want him alive, Matilda said.
She cried on through the morning as graves were dug. There were a dozen men to bury, and the ground was hard. Captain Salazar sat with his back to a wagon wheel as the men dug the graves. He was weak from loss of blood. He had reloaded his pistol and kept it in his hand all day, afraid the brief commotion might encourage the Texans to rebel. His caution was justified. Stirred by the shooting, several of the boys talked of making a fight. Blackie Slidell was for it, and also Jimmy Tweed. Both men had had enough of Mexican rule. Gus listened but didn't encourage the rebellion. His friend Call had collapsed from being made to walk when he wasn't able. He was weaker than Salazar and more badly injured. Escape would mean leaving him behind, and Gus had no intention of leaving him behind. Besides, Matilda was incoherent with grief. Four men had to pull her loose from Shadrach's body before it could be buried. The Mexican soldiers might mostly be boys, but they had had the presence of mind to kill Caleb Cobb. Since they had all the guns, rebellion or escape seemed a long chance. They had planned a shelter for the night in a village called San Saba, but the burials and the weakness of Captain Salazar kept them in place until it was too late to travel more than a few miles. That night a bitter wind came from the north, so cold that the men, Mexicans and Texans alike, couldn't think of anything but warmth. The Texans even agreed to be tied if they could only share the campfires. No one slept. The wind keened through the camp. Matilda, having no Shadrach to care for, covered Call with her body. Before dawn, they had burned both wagons. "How far is that village, Captain?" Bigfoot asked. Dawn was gray and the wind had not abated.
"Too far. 20 miles, Captain Salazar said.
"We have to make it tomorrow. We've got nothing else to burn," Bigfoot said.
"Call will die if he has to sleep in the open without no fire," Matilda said.
"Let's lope along then, boys," Bigfoot said.
"I'll help you with Woodrow, Matty," Gus said. "He looks poorly to me."
"Not as poorly as my Shad," Matilda said.
Between them, they got Carl to his feet. All day, Carl struggled through the barren country. The freezing wind seemed to slide through the slices in his back and sides. It seemed to blow right into him. He couldn't feel his feet, they were so cold. Gus supported him some, Matilda supported him some, even Long Bill Coleman helped out. "How'd it get so damn cold?" Jimmy Tweed muttered several times. "I never been no place where it was this cold. Even that snow wasn't this cold."
"You ought to leave me," Carl said. "I'm slowing you down." It grated on him that he had to be helped along.
"Maybe there'll be a bunch of goats in this village," Gus said.
He was very hungry. The wind in his belly made the wind from the north harder to bear. He had always had a fondness for goat meat. In his imagination, the village they were approaching was a wealthy center of goat husbandry, with herds in the hundreds of fat, tasty goats grazing in the desert scrub. He imagined a feast in which the goats they were about to eat were spitted over a good fire, dripping their juices into the flame. Yet as he struggled on, it became harder to trust in his own imaginings because there was no desert scrub. There was nothing but the rough earth, with only here and there a cactus or low thorn bush. Even if there were goats, there would be no firewood, no fire to cook them over. Captain Salazar rode in silence, in pain from his neck wound. Now and then the soldiers walking beside him would rub their hands against his horse, pressing their hands into the horsehair to gain a momentary warmth. Except when she was helping Carl, Matilda walked alone. She cried, and the tears froze on her cheeks and on her shirt. She wanted to go back and stay with Shadrach. She could sit by his grave until the wind froze her, or until the Indians came, or a bear. She wanted to be where he had died, and yet she could not abandon the boy, Woodrow Call, whose wounds were far from healed. He still might take a deep infection. Even if he didn't, he might freeze if she was not there to warm him. The cold had a bad effect on Johnny Carthage's sore leg. He struggled mightily to keep up, and yet as the day went on, he fell farther and farther behind. Most of the Mexican soldiers were freezing, too. They had no interest in the lame Texan who dropped back into their ranks and then behind their ranks.
"I'll catch you. I'll catch you," Johnny said over and over,
though the Mexicans weren't listening. By mid-afternoon, some of the other Texans had begun to lag, and many of the Mexican infantrymen as well. The marchers were strung out over a mile, then over two. Bigfoot went ahead, hoping for a glimpse of the village they were seeking, but he saw nothing, just the level desert plain. Behind them, there was a low bank of dark clouds. Perhaps it meant more snow. He felt confident that he himself could weather the night, even without fire, but he knew that many of the men wouldn't. They would freeze unless they reached shelter.
"I wonder if we even know where we're going. We might be missing that town," Bigfoot said to Gus. "If we miss it, we're in for frosty sleeping."
"I don't want to miss it. I hope they have goats," Gus said.
He was half carrying Call at the time. Bigfoot dropped back to speak with Salazar.
The captain was plodding on, but he was glassy-eyed from pain and fatigue.
"Captain, I'm fearful," Bigfoot said. "Have you been to this place? What's it called?"
"San Saba," Salazar said. "No, I have not been to it."
"I hope it's there," Bigfoot said. "We've got some folks that won't make it through the night unless we find shelter. Some of them are my boys, but quite a few of them are yours."
"I know that, but I am not a magician," Salazar said. "I cannot make houses where there are no houses, or trees where there are no trees."
"Why don't you let us go, Captain?" Bigfoot asked. "We ain't all going to survive this. Why risk your boys just to take us south? Caleb Cobb was the man who thought up this expedition, and he's dead."
Captain Salazar rode on, still glassy-eyed for some time before answering. When he did speak, his voice was cracked and hoarse.
"I cannot let you go, Mr. Wallace," he said. "I'm a military man, and I have my orders."
"Dumb orders, I'd say," Bigfoot said. "We ain't worth freezing to death for. We haven't killed a single one of your people. All we've done is march 1,500 miles to make fools of ourselves, and now we're in a situation where half of us won't live even if you do let us go. What's the point?"
Salazar managed a smile, though the effort made his face twist in pain.
"I didn't say my orders were intelligent, merely that they were mine," he said. "I've been a military man for 20 years, and most of my orders have been foolish. I could have been killed many times because of foolish orders. Now I have been given an order so foolish that I would laugh and cry if I weren't so cold and in such pain."
Bigfoot said nothing. He just watched Salazar.
"Of course you're right," Salazar went on. "You marched a long way to make fools of yourselves, and you've done no harm to my people. If you had, by the way, you would have been shot. Then all of us would have been spared this wind. But my orders are still mine. I have to take you to El Paso, or die trying."
"It might be the latter, Captain," Bigfoot said. "I don't like that cloud." Soon a driving sleet peppered the men's backs. As dusk fell, it became harder to see. The sleet coated the ground and made each step agony for those with cold feet.
"I fear we've lost Johnny," Bigfoot said. "He's back there somewhere, but I can't see him. He might be a mile back, or he might be froze already."
"I'll go back and get him," Long Bill said.
"I wouldn't," Bigfoot said. "You need all you've got to make it yourself."
"No, Johnny's my compañero," Long Bill said. "I reckon I'll go back. If we die tonight, I expect I should be with Johnny."
It took Gus and Matilda both to keep Carl going. The sleet thickened on the ground until it became too slippery for him to manage. Finally, the two of them carried him, his arms over their shoulders, his body warmed between their bodies. As the darkness came on and the sleet blew down the wind like birdshot, doom was in the mind of every man. All of them, even Bigfoot Wallace, veteran of many storms, felt that it was likely that they would die during the night. Long Bill had gone loyally back into the teeth of the storm to find his compañero, Johnny Carthage. Captain Salazar was slumped over the neck of his horse, unconscious. His neck wound had continued to bleed until he grew faint and passed out. The Mexican soldiers walked in a cluster, except for those who lagged. They had only one lantern. The light illumined only a few feet of the frigid darkness. As the darkness deepened, the cold increased, and the men began to give up. Texan and Mexican alike came to a moment of resignation. They ceased to be able to pick their feet up an inch forward over the slippery ground. They thought but to rest a moment until their energies were restored, but the rest lengthened, and they did not get back up. The sleet coated their clothes. At first they sat, their backs to the wind and the sleet. Then the will to struggle left them, and they lay down and let the sleet cover them. It was Gus McCrae with his keen vision who first saw a tiny flicker of light far ahead.
"Why, it's a fire," he said. "If it ain't a fire, it's some kind of light."
"Where?" Matilda asked. "I can't see nothing but sleet."
"No, there's a fire. I seen it," Gus said. "I expect it's that town."
One of the Mexican soldiers heard him and prodded his captain awake. Salazar, too, felt that he would not survive the night. The wound Caleb Cobb had given him was worse than he had thought. He had bled all day, the blood freezing on his coat. Now a soldier had awakened him with some rumor of a light,
although the sleet was blowing and he himself could not see past his horse's head. There was no light, no town. The blood had dripped down to his pants, which were frozen to the saddle. Instead of delivering the invading Texans to El Paso,